what's going on? There's a war zone here today out in the heartland, but the union's here to stay. Those multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true, but they declared a war.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor reports produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Jobs, jobs, jobs. We feature the voice of a labor leader who is building bridges between workers internationally and sees the ties that bind the labor and environmental movements in the U.S. Leo Girard, president of the United Steelworkers with members in the USA and Canada, is a co-founder of the Apollo Alliance, whose goal is developing efficient energy alternatives to fossil fuels and jobs, jobs, jobs. Girard's multidimensional interest has made him a leader in advocacy for job creation, the creation of green jobs as the way to re-industrialize the U.S., and he is fighting to make sure that the U.S. trade relations change so that jobs are kept.
President Girard spoke recently at a forum sponsored by a group called Rekindling Reform and by the Murphy Institute for Worker Education and Labor Studies.
About trying to organize a activist militant labor movement. What we believe in the steelworkers is that the union has to be an instrument of social and economic justice. And for quite some time, I and my predecessors have been saying that the steelworkers union is not a slot machine union. You don't put your dues in and every couple of months pull the lever down and see what kind of coins fall out and think that that's the only thing you do. But you can't make the lives of your members better unless you're making the lives of everybody in society better. So you have an obligation to not only fight for your members, but you have an obligation to fight for a better society, which takes us into all kinds of different battles than simply collective bargaining battles. We've been trying for a long time now to restructure our union so that it has the capacity to be activist. We've been trying to build that infrastructure in the union so we have that network. To give you an example of how effective it can be, we were bringing forward a trade case and we wanted to have some letters written. In less than 3 weeks, we generated 100,000 letters. And I would suspect that out of that 100,000, we probably had 70,000 that were individually done and 30,000 that were somebody running off form letters. But even if they're running off form letters, that's a piece of mail that's going to somebody who's got to take notice. Then we have our rapid response conference that we hold. All of these things we've done so that we can give people a place to get involved in the union. And not everybody wants to be a grievance officer. Not everybody wants to be on the safety committee. Not everybody wants to be in the political committee. So we created more space for people to find a role to get involved in. And then we've tried to decide, how do we take on the issues of the day? One of the ways we decided to take on what we saw was the upcoming issue. Campaigns for America's Future, the Sierra Club and the Steelworkers were the founding partners in creating the Apollo Alliance. The Apollo Alliance was designed and the name was picked to make a very strong statement, and it was that there were good jobs in what I would call climate change manufacturing. And that's what the Apollo Alliance was designed to do, is to develop policy, think about and promote how going to renewable energy could be a positive in revitalizing American industrial infrastructure. We thought, those of us that were in that original group, that we should be bold and we should really make a strong statement. And so what we said is that as part of the Apollo Alliance, we're recommending that America spend $30 billion over 10 years in renewable energy. And we thought that was bold. In 2006, think real hard if you ever heard the word Apollo in a presidential campaign or in a senatorial campaign. We couldn't get anybody to use it. It was too radical. So we concluded that we had good ideas, but we had no juice. We had nothing on the ground. We had nobody to generate this. So Carl Pope, myself, and Dave Foster got together and decided we'd create the Blue-Green Alliance. And it talks about the Sierra Club and the Steelworkers Union creating this alliance, and we would work on three things: climate change, trade, and toxics in the workplace. And Carl and I, in the 08 cycle then, went on the road, and we took community leaders from the Sierra Club and local union leaders from the steelworkers, and we did joint trainings, and we meshed it together in the Blue-Green Alliance. We went on the road, and we did 6 or 7 cities where we held forum, and we brought elected folks or people that were running for office. So we did Minnesota, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And all of a sudden, we found that there was a real interest in this among environmentalists and blue-collar workers. 2 weeks ago, we admitted the Union of Concerned Scientists and the NRDC to the Blue-Green Alliance, and now the collective membership of the organizations that form the Blue-Green Alliance is 13.2 million. The Blue-Green Alliance has now got more people on the ground talking about climate change, talking about green jobs, than I think almost any other organization that's promoting this issue in the country. We've got dozens and dozens of our local leaders who now play a role in the Blue-Green Alliance, so we've changed that whole dynamic. We've now been able to run from place to place and kill the myth that was created by the same people and the same values that say you can't have a good pension and high wages. You got to choose one or the other. You can't have a clean workplace and good jobs. I mean, I can remember growing up and driving by a paper mill with my dad to go see my uncle, and the smell and the stink, I'd lay on the back seat of the floor and pinch my nose in my dad's car, and my dad would say, "Knock that off, that's the smell of good jobs." And you were raised with this choice between polluted environment and good jobs, promoted by the same people who would tell you that you can't have good benefits and good wages. What we've been able to do with the Blue-Green Alliance is kill that myth. Good jobs or a clean environment. You're either going to have both or you'll have neither in the long run. The next piece of that is how do you generate the next level of industrial job? And the reality is this. The aggressive right-wing promotion of unregulated trade or trade that is regulated in the corporate financial interests started the economic demise of America. The whole issue of so-called free markets is a myth. There can be no such thing as a free market. All markets need to have some form of regulation. If you want the purest form of free market, in my view, there's a terrific example this week. The purest form of a free market is when you give someone the choice to pay $75 for fire protection and they forget to buy it. That's the market. You want a service, you buy it. You want a pension, put your money in the stock market. You want a health care, get a voucher. The deregulation of trade, or the regulation of trade in the wrong interests, the deregulation or minimal regulation of financial markets, the deregulation of industry, there'd be some that would argue that the deregulation have kept costs down. I think there's other ways of keeping costs down. I do know this. When I get my electric bill, I got to sit down for 10 minutes to try to decipher what the hell it says and what I'm paying for. When I go to the airline, I feel real lucky when I get a seat where I can actually not fold my legs under me so that my knees don't hit the wall. If you look at what happened to the deregulated financial markets when people were many ways lied to, and I'll spend time on trade, everything that we were told, I'll start with NAFTA because before that's a little harder to document. Take everything you were told from NAFTA on. Turned out to be not true. Everything the labor movement said would happen turned out to be true. You remember being told that one of the reasons we needed to pass NAFTA so we could stop the flood of illegal immigration. One of the things we did, we destroyed Mexican farming, family farming, by flooding them with our subsidized products. But in exchange for that, we gave them jobs in factories along the border. Then after we had millions of them in factories along the border, and there's still lots there, and their currency went for a dump, whatever it is now, it's 16, 17 years after. Mexican workers' wages as a percentage of American workers' wages is worse off now than it was at the time of NAFTA, and our real wages have fallen. So we've made Mexican workers worse off. We put them in those factories in the Maquila, and once we had them there, we went off and did PNTR with China, and 5,000 factories left the Maquilas and went to China. Now, if you're a Mexican worker on this side of the border, you're starving, on that side of the border, you can have a chance to eat. What do you think you're going to do? The most important thing we could do to stop illegal immigration to America is make sure that we help the Mexican raise their standard of living. People don't leave their family and their home behind because they want to come here and cut somebody's goddamn grass. They leave because they're desperate. Then if you look what's happened in America during that period of time, year after year after year, we've had a record-breaking trade deficit. There's only 2 years in the last 25 where we didn't break the record. This may be the third. 08 and 09, we didn't break records. Because in 08, we went in the tank, and 09, we stayed in the tank, and we'll see what happens in 2010 by the end of the year. I don't know. I do know that the last couple of months, we set records with China. So, again, everything we were told about PNTR with China has turned out to be not true. We were told that the low-end jobs would leave, and we'd all become high-end workers. Probably a lot of you go for your x-rays at the hospital, or your cardiograms and all that, and they'll give you the reading on that in a couple of days. That stuff sent over to China or India or Bangladesh or somewhere. And some radiologist that's making next to nothing reads your thing and sends it back. And that job that you went to school for to be a radiologist or an x-ray reader, whatever they call that thing, doesn't exist. We had a $79 billion, with a B, $79 billion, deficit in what's called advanced technology products with China and India. The modern wind turbine, anybody know where it came from? Who would have ever thought that the modern wind turbine would be invented in Sandusky, Ohio? Would you assume there'd be a turbine factory in Sandusky, Ohio? I don't know if they make helicopters. I know they don't make wind turbines. In the last 3 years, China has announced it's going to dominate the world market in solar panel production, in solar energy. China now produces 40% of the world's solar panels. That's pretty close to domination. China has doubled its exports of wind turbines to America. In the economic renewal program, think back to our $30 billion. In the economic renewal program, I think there was something like $80 or $85 billion, I forget the number, for renewable energy programs. But the renewable energy programs, that opening in the last 2 years, you got to have that wind farm up or that solar farm up or that geothermal unit up, you got to have that up within 2 years. In a section of the budget that was passed for that is a section called 48C, which is the amount of money that will be put set aside so that you could start a facility that would build those panels or turbines or geothermal units. And there's $5 billion in that. Now, I'm not very smart, and I'm certainly not the smartest pencil in the box or the brightest light on the elevator. But if I give you $85 billion to set up a wind farm, and you got to do it in 2 years, and I give you $5 billion to help factories do it, and it takes 2.5 years to get your factory licensed and up and get the other capital and get all that, where will this come from? Almost anywhere but us. Hence comes the inability to raise capital from banks that are already being chiselers, already can make more money by just sitting on their money because we're giving them money at next to no cost. So you can't raise money from banks. You can't get access to the government support in quick enough time to put your factory up to service the new wind farm that's going to go up. And all of a sudden you read in the paper that the Chinese are going to build a wind farm in West Texas and they're going to get our tax dollars to do it. And the Steelworker Union said, the hell with that. And we went to allies in the House and in the Senate and started to raise hell. And Chuck Schumer and Sherrod Brown and a few others started making noise that they would bring forward legislation that would preclude the use of American taxpayer dollars for imported renewable energy products. All of a sudden, the steelworkers start getting calls from the Chinese. And we've entered into agreement with what I think is a shell company called A-Power. I don't even think they exist. I think they might have made one turbine. But their arm is Shenyang Power. Shenyang is the power arm of the city of Shenyang in China. So we've entered into an understanding with them that if they're going to stand up any wind farms in America, they're going to do it by using American-made products and that they give the union neutrality and card check if it's in a new facility. That only comes about through all of that network I've been weaving through. Because when the Texas wind farm hit the news, Rapid Response hit the button and started writing letters. And people started, what the hell, we're going to get this spread all over us. Then we figured out, how could they ship those turbines here? Turbines are big. How can they do that cost efficiently? They can do it because China has a different economic system than we do. They get all kinds. I mean, we couldn't believe. I couldn't catalog the kind of incentives and support that they get to get to dominate or to double their exports. I'll tell you a steel story. We got a trade lawyer, Terry Stewart from Washington. We started doing a lot of research. And we filed a 5,800-page filing with the U.S. Trade Commission under a section of the Trade Act called Section 301, alleging five specific violations of WTO rules by China. We only filed it for what we would euphemistically call green jobs or renewable energy jobs. And the reason we did that is strategic in two ways. One, if we don't find a way to catch hold of industrial manufacturing for renewable energy really quickly in the next year or two, America will be so far behind it can never catch up. And there'll be no difference in relying on Chinese wind turbines versus imported oil. There'll be no difference in relying on an imported solar panel, imported wind turbine, imported geothermal than imported oil. You'll have to rely on someone else. The other thing is that forget about whether you're pro or con the nuclear industry. Everybody goes every which way. You need a diversified energy strategy. But not long after the announcement of the Texas wind farm is an announcement by our government that they're going to fund $7 to $8.5 billion of support for the first two nuclear reactors on the drawing board down south. And you scratch your head, you figure, how are they going to do that? Westinghouse announces that it's already got the specs for that, and they want to get this up within a couple of years. You go and you research the specs, and you find that the specs have been written to exclude the American steel industry and building the containment vessels because we didn't make the steel the way that they had in the spec. And all of a sudden, you find that the specs are written to meet Asian steel suppliers. Then you scratch your head and you say, well, why would Westinghouse do that? Because Westinghouse is no longer owned by an American. Westinghouse is owned by the Japanese. They wrote the specs to serve their industry. I have nothing against that. The question is, why the hell aren't we doing that? So the steelworkers again wrote off a letter to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC, and we demanded an investigation of every part. PLA should include manufacturing. So those are the fights we're having. And I spend a lot of time on that because I'm absolutely convinced that if we don't find a way to revitalize American manufacturing, there is no way out of the economic mess we're in. How do you generate wealth in a country? You can't generate wealth by selling collateral debt offerings. We've proven that, haven't we? You can't generate wealth by creating illusions that this paper is worth something when it's not. You can't generate wealth by tranching bad mortgages and selling them as AAA bonds. We've proven that. You hear them talking about the deficit. Does anyone in this room know what the accumulated trade debt America has poured over itself since passage of NAFTA? The last numbers I saw was we've accumulated a trade debt over the, whatever it is, 17 years now, of roughly $7.2 trillion. Now, that isn't necessarily a debt you hold on your books. Those are wealth transfers. That's somebody buying your shit, literally. And you can't, you're paying it off. So you set that over here. And this year, we're heading towards $500 billion. And if we get back on the trajectory we were on before the economic collapse, the trajectory that we were on before 08 would have led us to almost $1 trillion by 2012. And I've said to all kinds of economists, and no one has given me an answer yet, I've asked two things. What do you think will happen to America when we hit an annual trade debt of $1 trillion a year, if that trajectory keeps going? Question number two, if having a huge, huge trade deficit is so good for the economy, why aren't other nations clamoring for one? Right? You hear the Rubenistas and that crowd, the Clintonians, you hear all of them talking about how, you know, opening world markets, opening trade is good, and da-da-da-da. And the fact that we can hold this trade debt is a signal of the strength of the American economy and all of that. We've been devaluing our currency as quick as we can try to get it devalued, and the Chinese have been buying it up as quick as they can to keep us from devaluing as much as they would like us, and blah, blah, blah. All that smoke and mirrors. This is a huge issue that is not getting any attention. So you set that over here, and we're going to have to fight about that. And if you read just most recently, that I think again in the New York Times someone wrote, maybe the Wall Street Journal, free trade is now falling out of favor. I was on a phone call the other day, don't need to say who was all on it, but there was a whole bunch of sort of stammering and saying that they need a new story to tell. They need to recalibrate the message. You can recalibrate the message all you want when trade is costing you jobs. That's the issue. So you put that over there. You put this stupid political environment we're in, where last week, such a common sense proposal, we would reward companies that bring jobs back from overseas to America and we would take away the subsidy that we give companies to move jobs out of the country. Somebody's got to tell me what's wrong with that. Every Republican voted no, plus four Democrat senators. I can't figure that out. I cannot figure that out. So you set that there. You set our 301 petition there. You set that we've brought trade cases against China, steelworkers have, on coated free sheet paper, on pipe and tube, on other steel products, and we've won every case. Do you know why? All you need is the facts, because that's the way China does business. And if you don't hold them accountable, they won't change. And I'm not anti-Chinese. I'm not anti-trade. I really believe that nations have to trade. I just believe that you ought to have it on fair footing. Then you take the other mountain of stupidity. We worked our ass off because we wanted some fairness. We wanted changes in the healthcare system. We wanted a healthcare system that everyone could have healthcare and could save the country money. You know which system would have saved the country the most money? Single payer would have saved over $400 billion a year. We have this huge debate about letting the tax break for ultra-rich continue. And the average person doesn't have a clue what it's about, right? And you scratch your head and you say, why are we having this debate? Well, the reason you're having this debate is during the Bush gang, they passed the tax breaks that expire now because by having them expire less than 10 years, they didn't have to account for them. So all these Republicans that fought for these tax breaks for the ultra-rich and a little bit for us, a little bit, your $36 tax break doesn't do very much compared to the millionaire's $36,000 tax break, but you got a little bit. Off the books, allegedly, cost somewhere between $750 and $900 billion. These same bastards, and I believe they are now fighting, blaming Obama for the deficit. And we fought two wars off the books. And so last month, we have this huge protracted debate about extending unemployment benefits for people who lost their jobs as a result of Wall Street corruption, where not sufficiently went to jail yet. One poor guy went to jail. He got caught. It's easier to nail one guy, right? He'll probably get an ankle bracelet and hang around home. You know? So we had this big fight about that. And Republicans get up and say, well, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to show us how you can pay for it by cutting something else. You don't hear a word about that and extending the tax cut for the ultra-rich. And what are we doing? We as the collective we. We're getting amnesia. And we're letting the guys, and they're mostly guys, who created the mess, blame us because we inherited their mess. So our union has built this infrastructure inside the union. And today, that infrastructure is working as hard as I can make it work because there is no path to success if we go back to what was being done the way it was being done. And we have to talk about jobs. I fundamentally believe that the next industrial revolution will come from putting society to work, and America and Canada, where I'm from, should lead on remanufacturing itself to fight climate change. Our union said in 1990 that climate change was going to be the greatest social problem that society would face in the years coming. And you know what? I'm pretty naive, I think. I still want to think that I'm an optimist, although some days I have to kick myself. There's millions of jobs in taking carbon out of the air, taking greenhouse gases out of the air. What we need is the political will. We need the direction. We need the desire. We need the consensus. We need the commitment. Imagine how many jobs you'd create if our federal and state governments got together and said that they're going to start a retrofitting campaign, retrofitting to current science, current knowledge, current industrial capacity of every municipal, state, and federal building built prior to 1960, bringing up to the highest energy efficiency standards. And that would be a 10-year project. Then the next 10-year project would be taking the buildings between 1960 and 1980 and bringing up to current scientific standards. Think about the millions of jobs. Then if we said to employers, and I'm not thinking always of the U.S. Steels and the General Motors and all that, but the average employers, the small shops and the foundries and the factories and the folks who do little jobs, the mom and pops as we call them in our union. Imagine if you give them the kind of financial incentive, give them the technical support, train people in universities to go out and give small businesses the kind of engineering support they can't get because they can't afford to hire an engineer, and have them help in industrial retrofitting so that they're using less energy, that they're more efficient, and they can pay their workers better as a result. And then think about what happens if America says, we're going to understand that mass transit creates jobs, puts high-speed rail back on. Could we do high-speed rail? guess what? There's only two rail manufacturers left in America. Ike Gitlin comes from one in Steelton, PA, and the other one's up in Pueblo, Colorado. So if somebody said that over the next 2 years we're going to put in 5,000 miles of high-speed rail, we'd have to get the rail from China. If someone says over the next 20 years we're going to do 25,000 miles across the country of high-speed rail, someone would build new rail mills and people would go back to work. If America says we're going to support the Steelworkers 301 petition and we're not going to let the Chinese dump their wind turbines and their solar panels in America, we're going to develop a solar panel and a wind turbine industry ourselves. Because we invented it, we'd have tens of thousands of people working in those industries, and we'd be more efficient. So for me, I never ever dreamt. I pinched myself lots of times figuring, how the hell did I ever get this job? This is, you know, I get paid to tell people to go to hell. I get paid to give people shit, and I get paid to think. I mean, it's got to be one of the best jobs in the world, you know. But I really believe this. If we don't turn the labor movement from what it is now into a comprehensive activist organization from the top of the AFL-CIO to the newest local union, so that we're activists for social change as well as economic well-being for our members, present, past, and future. And if we don't take on the challenge of rebuilding industrial America, my kids and grandkids will have a lesser opportunity in life than I did. And I'm at the point in my life, I've been there for a while now, where it ain't about me. In this economic meltdown, I got six adults in my family, my wife and I, my two daughters and their two husbands. For a year, there was only one of us had a job. I can survive that. I have a good living. I can help my kids. But when I'm not here, what are my grandkids going to do? That's the challenge. We're at a turning point. We got to build an activist labor movement. We got to mobilize. We got to do One Nation every Saturday in different parts of the world, different parts of the country. And we've got to fight for a rebirth of industrial America. And then we'll be able to sit in our rocking chairs and say that we help create a better world and a cleaner climate.
And you were listening to Leo Girard, president of the 850,000-member United Steelworkers of America, on the need for an activist labor movement to rebuild the country by creating green jobs. The music has been Steelworker Eddie Starr's rendition of Ann Feeney's song, War on the Workers. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. We invite you to visit our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org. That's buildingbridgesradio.org.
There's a war on the workers. We just do what